and about your life. He patted my feet under the blankets, then clicked the light off and closed the door behind him. Chapter 35, Mags, August 1970. We rented cabins at the state park in Gulf Shores after Hurricane Lorraine blew through. Lorraine didn't hit us dead on. She rolled ashore in Biloxi, close enough to call for evacuation notices in our area, which we ignored as usual, and to take down much of the electricity in Sweet Bay, but far enough away that the beaches were back to normal after a few weeks. We were all exhausted after the cleanup efforts in Sweet Bay, what with all the downed trees and closed businesses. When we got our heads above water, I suggested the vacation. There were seven of us, Jenny and me, Dot and Bert, Major and Glory Gregg, who checked in for an extended stay not long after Robert died, and Eugene Norman, the potter-turned-glassblower. Starla, Gary, and Daisy had long since moved on. After a quick call to secure the cabins, we packed a few things and piled into the Gregg's orange van to drive the half hour it took to get to the sugar-white sand of Gulf Shores. It was late August, the last weekend before Jenny started third grade. Jenny and I were in the back row of the van with Glory. Dot and Eugene sat in the row in front of us, with Bert and Major in charge of getting us to the beach in one piece. Jenny had just finished telling us a long story of how she and her friend from school, Doreen, had slipped an earthworm into the school bully's desk during recess. Jenny laughed out loud and looked back and forth at Glory and me until we laughed too. It was hard to be around Jenny and not feel lighter. Glory took Jenny's soft face in her hands and smoothed her hair back. "Child, you are a beautiful creature, but I must say you look nothing like your mother." Glory looked at me. She must have her father's look. Was he as blonde and fair as this? Dot turned sideways in her seat so she could make eye contact with me. She raised an eyebrow and waited for my answer. "Mama, was he?" Jenny asked. The first time Jenny asked about her father, I couldn't have forced the right words out even if I'd wanted to, which I didn't, because she was too young. I gave her the same easy answer I gave everyone, that he died from a heart attack when Jenny was only three. I'd tell her the truth one day when she could handle it, or maybe when I could handle speaking of it. What Glory said was true. My child looked nothing like me. She was the spitting image of her father. She had William's fair coloring, wheat-colored hair, and full eyelashes. She also had my daddy's tall forehead and mother's strong nose. She deserved to know the truth about her father and her family, but not at the tender age of nine. He sure was, sugar. I patted Jenny's hand. My eyes turned out the window, looking at nothing in particular. We arrived at the park to discover there had been a mix-up, and only one cabin was available for rent. Several had been damaged in the storm, and it seemed lots of other people had the same idea we did. It was the weekend before Labor Day, after all. "It's a fine cabin," the woman at the front desk told me. "It's one of our larger units, so you won't feel too cramped." She eyed our ragtag group as if she didn't believe the words she was saying. "Cramped? Seven people in a two-room cabin will be more than cramped." "Major, don't make a scene," Eugene said. "We drove all the way here. We can't turn around and go home now." "Home is 30 minutes away. We'd be back before Columbo starts." Before Major and Eugene could continue arguing, or worse, compare the merits of Columbo with those of Hawaii Five-O, a favorite pastime at the hideaway, I spoke up. "Enough! We already live together, so what's the problem with sharing tighter quarters for a few days? We won't be in the cabin much anyway." "Mark it down," I said to the clerk. "We're staying." Once the decision was made, everyone got into the spirit of vacation. Bert emptied the coolers of food supplies he'd brought for the weekend and set out ingredients for a feast. Glory retrieved her suitcase of board games and beach toys, and everyone relaxed enough to enjoy the last real weekend of summer. At some point during our stay, I took a notebook in a plastic lounge chair to the edge of the shoreline. I nestled the chair down in the sand, pushed my toes under the thin layer of seashells, and started to write. A little later, 15 minutes or an hour, I couldn't be sure, Dot appeared and sat in a chair next to me. Baby oil glistened on her shins, and she smelled like a coconut. She'd brought her bathing suit, a perfect yellow polka dot bikini, especially for this trip, and she'd hardly taken it off since we'd arrived. She felt good in it, and it showed. "Does that have anything to do with Jenny?" she asked. I looked at her. "It's a letter. How'd you know?" "I knew that conversation in the van got to you. Then here you are writing away in your little notebook. I just put two and two together. When are you going to give it to her?" I shrugged. "One day, when the time is right." I could feel her stare, but I kept my eyes on the water. "She's the best part of us. He would have loved her so much." "You sure about that? Why hasn't he come back?" "I don't know, but he must have a good reason." Dot didn't believe me. I could see the pity in her eyes despite the oversized sunglasses. I knew what she was going to say before she said it. "What if he met..." I cut her off quick. "Don't say it. You didn't know him. You didn't know us." "Okay, fair enough." She took a breath as if to speak, but paused. "What if he's dead?" "He can't be. I'd feel it." Dot held up her hands in surrender. "I'm just trying to help you figure this out. You say the two of you were in love, but I still see a man who abandoned you for no good reason." I sighed, and I still say it wasn't totally his fault. "Right, your parents and all that. Then where is he?" "Who knows?" I shrugged again. "Do you regret loving him?" "No," my voice was firm. "The only thing I regret is that I never actually told him I loved him. I never said those words. If I had, maybe he would have stayed and fought for me. That was the truest thing I'd said about William since he left, and the admission left me sore in my chest and a little angry. Regardless, it's been more than 10 years. I slapped my notebook closed. "Whatever the reason, he hasn't come back, and I have no way of knowing if or when he'll return. I have to make sure Jenny doesn't go through her whole life thinking her dad was a fine chap who just happened to die of a heart attack. Are you going to tell her about Annabelle?" "No, there's no reason. Robert's actions don't affect her. He wasn't her dad, and at this point, she hardly remembers anything about him. Her real father is, kind and good. That's what she needs to know. He never would have wanted to do anything to hurt his family. But he did. He hurt me." I pushed that thought away, just out of arm's reach. The water lapped farther and farther up our ankles each time it rolled in. To our left, a cluster of gray and white sandpipers nibbled at tiny clams as they burrowed into the soft, wet sand. The sun had inched down in the sky while I'd been writing, and only a few brightly colored umbrellas dotted the beach. Dot leaned her head back on the chair and stretched out her legs. She was long and lean and brown as a berry. "So, when are you going to let Bert get you pregnant?" Dot let out a half laugh, half snort. "You don't beat around the bush, do you? Sounds like someone else I know." I flicked a few grains of sand at her with my fingers. "Anyway, it's about time. You've been married a while, and we could use some more little ones running around the house again." "What? And ruin my good figure?" Dot wiggled her hips. Grains of sand stuck to the baby oil shimmering on her skin. I laughed and handed her a towel. "What about you?" She brushed sand off her legs and repositioned herself on the chair. "You could quit with those crazy hats and outfits, and men would line up out the door for you. You know they would." "Yes, those sweet bay men really ring my bell." "It's a big world out there, that's all I'm saying. If there's more outside Sweet Bay, I don't need it. And I'm done with men. I gave it a go twice, and you see how far that got me. At 33, I'm long past the age of letting myself get swept up by a man, no matter how handsome or charming he may be." The words sounded believable, even to me, but I knew my heart. If William had walked onto that beach right then and there, I would have run to him and thrown my arms around him, no questions asked. I probably would have hit him, too, but where my heart was concerned, it would always belong to him. I leaned my head back on my chair. The sun, still strong even in the late afternoon, baked my legs. The searing heat felt good and cleansing. I gave in to the pull of sleep until the rising tide skimmed the backs of my legs. At the same time, Bert's voice drifted to us from farther up the beach. "We're going to have to toss out life preservers if y'all don't move back," he called. Jenny trailed behind him, a sand bucket in one hand and a stringy clump of seaweed in the other. "Come on back to the cabin," he said. "I have grilled shrimp and West Indies salad waiting on the deck." He turned to Jenny and said something we couldn't hear. Then the two of them took off, running back the other way. My sweet girl ran as fast as her legs would carry her, beating Bert to the cabin by a nose. She gave him a high five and climbed the steps to the cabin. Lord, I love that girl. I tightened my grip on the letter in my hands, the letter that would one day tell Jenny everything she needed to know about her father. Nothing more and nothing less. Chapter 36. Sarah. July. I didn't roll over until 10 the next morning. As soon as I did, the pounding started, reminding me why I always stopped with one drink. With the shop to run and clients to please, I didn't have time to sleep in and nurse hangovers. My phone was on top of the blanket next to me. I took a deep breath and called Crawford. "Are you okay?" he asked in place of a greeting. "I'm fine. I'm sorry for not calling earlier. Alan came to town and..." It was a limp excuse, but it was all I had. I hadn't deciphered anything else going on in my head yet. "I'm glad you got to see him. I'll back off now that I know you're okay. I was just worried. Thanks." "What do you mean, back off?" "Look, I know you've got a lot going on and you have decisions to make. I want to help you with this, but I understand if you need to do it alone." Whether I did it alone or had help, deciding what to do would not be easy. The situation had already tied my stomach in knots. "And this should go without saying," he continued, "but if you have second thoughts about us, about me, just be honest." "No, I'm not." But was I? Thoughts swirled through my head like a tornado, but I couldn't put my finger on which ones were about the house and which were about Crawford. "Come on, Sarah. It's the first time you haven't taken my calls. This big thing happens, Sammy and his news about the house, and all of a sudden, you pull away." He'd been nothing but caring and concerned about me, and here I was trying to avoid the hard part, just like Alan said. What kind of person did that? "I'm sorry. I'm not having second thoughts about you or about us. I just feel like the rug was pulled out from under me. Before, everything felt so possible. Now, I don't know. If I'm not here in Sweet Bay, how would we..." He exhaled. "We'll figure it out, just like we said. Sammy may have pulled the rug out from under you, but I'm still here, and I'm not going anywhere. And that will stay the same whether or not Sammy goes through with his plan, okay?" I couldn't speak over the lump in my throat, so I just nodded, even though he couldn't see me. "Can I come see you?" he asked. "Yes, please. I don't want to do this alone." After we hung up, I turned over to find a glass of water and two Tylenol on the nightstand. As I swallowed them down, the sound of laughter found its way up the stairs and into my room. Downstairs, Alan was holding court in the kitchen, while Dot, Bert, Major, and Glory all drowned in laughter. Major laughed so hard he spilled his coffee. Alan grabbed a dish towel and helped him clean up. Bert clapped him on the back, not the sight I expected to see. "Good morning," Dot said to me quietly when I entered. She put her arm around me and I patted her hand. "Your friend fits right in. Mags would have loved him." "You're right. She never would have let him leave. Can I talk to you for a minute?" I gestured into the adjacent dining room. "Sure, hon." We sat down at the table. In the middle was an arrangement of small vases. I reached over and ran my finger across the thin porcelain lip of a vase with tiny painted flowers. Mags loved having fresh flowers in the house. Dot picked up one of the vases and turned it over in her hand. I found a box full of these in the mudroom the other day. I was going to add them to our goodwill pile, but I thought better of it. These happy things deserve to be displayed. She wiped the dust off the vase with the hem of her skirt. You wanted to talk to me about something? Yes, I took a deep breath and then let it out slowly. I have some bad news. She waited, all the lightheartedness from the kitchen gone from her face. Sammy Grovner visited me a couple of days ago. Good grief, what does he want now? I didn't want to overwhelm her with the details, so I just gave her a brief rundown of Sammy's plan. But I don't understand, she said. He can't just swoop in and take the house, can he? I shrugged. I've already talked to Mr. Baines, and it sounds like my options are slim. Dot stared absently out the bay window, her chin propped in her hand. Her bottom lip trembled, and I had to look away. Finally, she reached over and took my hand. What are you going to do? I don't know. I'm not sure there's much I can do. I keep asking myself what Mags would do if she were here. How would she deal with Sammy? Dot smiled. Mags always knew just what to do in difficult situations. When it seemed there was no way out, she'd always find one little sliver of daylight and scratch herself out. But I'm not sure even Mags could get out of this one. All this work, I said, looking around. The room smelled like fresh paint and wood polish, and through the hall I could see a worker in the parlor coiling an extension cord around his arm. The renovations were turning the hideaway into a pearl instead of a crusty shell. Well, Dot said, if nothing can be done, this may force Bert and me to grow up after all, she chuckled. It's probably time anyway. We've been talking for ages about needing to make the move down to Florida where his kids are. I know Major and Glory have family back in Georgia. Maybe it's time for us all to move on. Her words were confident, but her eyes were sad. She patted my hand again, then rose and walked back to the kitchen. I followed her. From the doorway, we watched the scene before us. Bert mimed Major struggling to reel in a fish, while Glory narrated for Alan an episode that included Major falling in the water, only to discover it was an alligator on the end of the line. No one had ever seen him swim so fast. "Y'all go on and laugh," he said. "But let's see how fast you swim when a six-footer is snapping at your legs." Ah, there's Sarah, thank the Lord, a diversion. "Feeling okay?" Alan asked with a grin. "Fine. Thanks for the Tylenol." "I'm glad you two had a chance to catch up last night," Glory said. "You must have missed him. He's a hoot." "Come on," Alan linked his arm through mine. "Help me pack. I need to get back to New Orleans and run your shop." I trudged back up the front porch steps after seeing Alan off, but the approach of another vehicle stopped me before I made it to the top. I turned as Crawford's truck rumbled down the driveway toward me. Tension slipped off my shoulders like silk. He parked, crossed the gravel to the steps, and folded me into his arms. I pressed my cheek into the soft space under his ear and tightened my arms around him. When we pulled away, he smiled. "Better?" I took a deep, cleansing breath. "Yes. Thanks for coming." "I want to be here. We have work to do. I can make some phone calls and see if we can dig up anything that would make Sammy rethink his decision. There has to be something." I nodded. Tears threatened to fall, so I turned away. Crawford tipped my face back toward him. "It's all going to be okay, whatever happens." It almost feels like everything would have been better if I hadn't come here. I fixed the house up and got everyone's hopes up for a great future for the house. Now I'm letting them down. "You're not the one letting them down. It all would have happened the same way whether you were here or not. But by coming back, you got to know your grandmother, the real one. And you've reconnected with the folks here in the house who love you like you're their own granddaughter. But the house and all our work." "Don't give up on it yet. The hideaway is a part of you," he said. "It's your past, regardless of what Sammy tries to do. And who knows, it could even be part of your future. I nodded, and he took my hand. Now let's get to work. Chapter 37, Sarah, July. We spent the rest of the morning and most of the afternoon on the back porch, my laptop practically burning a hole in the cushioned ottoman, and both of our cell phones buzzing with activity. While Crawford called friends in town he thought might be able to pull some strings, I researched eminent domain, property laws, and anything else I could think of that might give us a loophole. I even called Mitch. "This isn't really my thing," he said when I told him the situation. "I mean, if you go to trial with it, I'm your guy, but I'm not sure I'm the right person to talk to about saving an old house." As he spoke, Crawford paced the back porch with his cell to his ear and a notebook in his hand, scrawling notes as he listened. He'd postponed a morning meeting and canceled plans to attend an important General Contractors Association meeting in Mobile. "You know what? Don't worry about it. I'm sure things here will be fine." "Are you sure?" Mitch asked. "I can probably ask around at the office and see if anyone is willing to take it on." "I'll take care of it." Crawford looked at me when I tossed my cell into the chair next to me. "Was that a friend?" he asked. I shook my head. "Just someone I thought might be able to help. Dead end." He leaned against the doorframe and crossed his arms. "That's most of what I've gotten, too. Don't worry, though. I still have a few people I can talk to." He looked at his watch. "I'm so sorry, but I've got to run. Missing my morning meeting wasn't a big deal, but I can't put off Mrs. Webb. She'll eat my apologies for dinner." I laughed. "You've done enough. Thank you." I walked him out and returned to my seat on the porch. Although the sun glinted off every shiny surface like a spotlight, without Crawford there to keep the sadness at bay, it crept back in. He seemed buoyed by the possibility of finding just the right loophole to fend off Sammy, but I wasn't as confident. Sammy may have been harmless years before, but it was only because he'd been busy laying the groundwork for what was happening now. I was glad Mags wasn't around to see it. That evening, I found Dot at the dining room table. Bert puttered around in the kitchen behind her, putting away pots and pans from dinner. "I'm turning in, girls," he said when he stuck his head in the doorway. He crossed the room to kiss Dot on the cheek. "Don't stay up too late, dear. We don't have to work it all out tonight." Bert walked into the hallway and disappeared up the stairs. I looked at Dot. "It's nothing," she said. "We're just talking about our next steps." She squeezed my hand. "It's been a big couple of days for you. It's a lot to digest." I sighed and shook my head. "I think I've hit my limit for sure." "You'll figure out what to do. You're Mags's granddaughter. You have spunk running deep in your veins." I bet William had some of that, too. Maybe it came from both of them, their DNA mixing and marrying, passing on down the line to me. Dot closed the magazine she'd been flipping through and pushed her chair back from the table. She stopped on her way out of the dining room. "I almost forgot to tell you. Bob Crow called today." I shrugged. "Who? Bob Crow? The roving reporter? Honey, you have been gone too long. He breaks all the big stories. From the Mobile Press Register." I shook my head. "It's a big deal for him to call." She seemed disappointed that I didn't hold him in the high esteem he obviously deserved. "He said he wanted to talk to you about the hideaway. I wrote his number down. It's by the coffee pot in the kitchen. Maybe he can help you with Sammy. That's what he does. He finds dirt on people that no one knew was there." "I'm sure there's plenty of dirt on Sammy, but I don't see what a reporter can do to fix this mess." "Just call him. See what he has to say." In lieu of responding, I smiled, which satisfied her. After she left, I picked up a few stray mugs from the dining room and carried them into the kitchen, the weight of the last couple days bearing down hard on my shoulders. I made my way toward the stairs, but stopped when I saw a light coming from the reading room in the back of the house. I walked to the doorway and peeked in. Gloria was asleep on the couch. her legs propped up on an ottoman. Her glasses had slipped down her nose, and she held a half-empty mug of tea that tipped precariously. I reached over and took the cup from her hand, careful not to wake her. I picked up the magazine lying face down on the cushion next to her, and saw the title, Georgia Land and Real Estate. She'd underlined several houses for sale and made notes in the margins. Could make this work. Part-time job at the armory. Everyone in the house was scrambling. I thought of what Crawford said earlier, that the hideaway was in me. It was my past, maybe even my future. Something clicked, and the heaviness in my brain and body receded for a moment. I grabbed Bob's phone number off the counter in the kitchen and took it upstairs with me. Before crawling into bed, I called and I left a message at his office. Mr. Crow, this is Sarah Jenkins from the hideaway. I'd like to talk. Chapter 38, Sarah, August. I woke a few days later to the sound of excited voices and footsteps in the downstairs hallway. The house didn't usually have that kind of activity until at least mid-morning, when Bert would flip through recipes for the evening meal, and Major would chide him for whatever choice he made. I dressed quickly and headed for the noise, but the doorbell rang before I reached the first floor. As I crossed the foyer to the front door, I saw the newspaper lying on the console table. A sneaky deal in Sweet Bay? The headline blared. I smiled. Mr. Crow must have done his job. I hope you don't mind that I spoke to that reporter, Mrs. Busby said in a rush, as soon as I pulled open the door. I've got to get up to the diner. But I just had to talk to you first. When Mr. Crow told me this place might be torn down because of Sammy, I couldn't help myself. Who does he think we are? The Sunset Strip? She shook her head and glanced at her watch. I'd hate to see anything along this stretch of the bay except the hideaway. Please let me know if there's anything else I can do. Neighbors came by and called throughout the morning, all of them offering their support. Mr. Crocker from the farm up the road shyly approached the house just as I was closing the door behind Norm Hammond, the town barber. Mr. Crocker said Mags had let him and his wife stay at the hideaway for a long weekend soon after the birth of their fifth child. We needed some time away from the demands of the farm, not to mention the kids, but we didn't have an extra dime in our pockets. The next thing we knew, your grandmother was on our doorstep telling us to pack our bags. She knew we'd had a tough year with the drought and adding an extra mouth to feed, and she wouldn't accept payment from us. Not in money, anyway. I left her fresh milk and eggs every morning for a month after that. That was 40 years ago, and I still haven't forgotten. Your grandmother was a gem, and this house was a lifesaver. Later, Mr. Grimerson stopped by and told how after Hurricane Lorraine blew through in the 70s, Mag's home was one of the only places that didn't lose power, something about being on a separate power grid. I had supplies in my store that people needed, but no one could drive anywhere downtown with so many trees down. Your grandmother rode her bicycle all the way to my store, helped me load supplies onto a wagon she pulled behind her bike, and then brought it all back to the hideaway. This became my temporary outpost. She opened her doors to people who needed a place to stay or just needed batteries and flashlights. She was always helping people in the most unexpected ways. During a lull in the action, Crawford pulled down the driveway with sausage biscuits from the diner for everyone in the house. I figured you'd be busy, being famous and all, he said to Dot and Glory as they helped him clear the dining room table of newspapers so he could set out the food. Famous isn't what we want to be, Glory said. Yeah, but not homeless is, Major said. So if it takes Mr. Crow and the Mobile Press Register drumming up support for the house, I'll take the fame. I'll be upstairs shaving if anyone needs me. No one's coming to take your picture, Major, Glory called as he left. She turned to us. I'd better go talk some sense into him. He'll be down here in his Sunday best before long. She hurried up the stairs behind him. With the room blessedly empty, Crawford pulled me to him. "I've missed you," he said into my neck, his lips tickling my skin. He put his hands on the sides of my face and kissed me. "You're in a good mood for someone whose hard work may be about to meet the wrecking ball." "Not going to happen. I have a feeling for these things."
"Oh, you do?" I asked.
"Mm-hmm. I also have a feeling we need to get out of here soon. I love your roommates, but..." Bert rounded the corner from the hall, his gaze down on yesterday's mail, and walked right into us. "Don't mind me," he said, disentangling himself. "I'll be out of your hair in a jiff."
"See what I mean?" Crawford whispered.
He kissed me again, soft and quick, then called out to Bert. "I brought enough food to feed an army, Bert. No need to run off." He handed me a cup of coffee, but before I could take a sip, the doorbell rang again. "No rest for the wanted," he said. "Better see who it is." I was just starting back up the front steps after chatting with a man from the Baldwin County Preservation Society when I heard a rustling in the azalea bushes at the side of the house. Clark Arrington pushed his way through, carrying a pair of loppers in his hand. "Oh, hey," he said when he saw me. "I always tried to keep these bushes from growing too tall for Mrs. Van Buren. I just figured I'd keep cutting them back until someone tells me to stop. But if you'd rather me not..."
"No, it's okay. Before, I probably would have told him we could take care of the bushes ourselves. But in light of everything that had happened, I appreciated Clark's desire to continue this trivial means of keeping the hideaway in shape."
"I'm sorry about what's happening to this old place," he said, his hands busy in the bushes along the edge of the porch. "Sammy's been talking about it for a while, but I didn't think he'd actually go through with it." So this was what Clark had been dropping hints about on the dock, and I'd thought he was just being a nuisance. "Thanks," I said. "Yeah, I've been doing some work for him here and there over the last year or so. He wanted me to help him on this deal, but I just couldn't do it. Not if it meant tearing down your grandmother's house. I kind of like the old bird." I laughed. "I'm glad to hear it, Clark." "I wasn't sure, to be honest. She was nice to me. She used to pay me in vegetables for my work around the yard, and if they ever had any leftover pie, she'd bring a slice across the street and leave it on the steps leading up to my apartment. She always covered it in plastic wrap to keep the ants away." Clark bent down to pick up the branches he'd cut, then, without saying goodbye, retreated through the space in the azalea bushes. By lunchtime, a banner had been erected at the end of the driveway facing Highway 55. "Sweet Bay supports the hideaway," it said. Several smaller homemade signs dotted the grass. "Protect our town. Go away, Sammy. And save Sweet Bay." The flood of neighbors and well-wishers slowed in the afternoon. I sank down in a chair at the dining table next to Bert, who was folding dish towels. "I can't even wrap my brain around what's happened today," I said.
"It's been a big day," Bert agreed. "I think it's been successful, though. Maybe Sammy will pull the plug on the whole deal."
"Sammy won't do it, but if the mayor fears he's angered too many people, maybe he'll back off." I reached over and grabbed a towel to fold. I never thought people in Sweet Bay cared anything about this place, or even liked Mags that much. So many people made fun of her. I can't believe they're stepping up now and giving her support.
"You don't have it quite right," Major said from the kitchen.
He walked into the dining room. "If you hadn't been stuck inside that teenage head of yours all those years ago, you might have figured that out." I opened my mouth, but he continued. "I'll be the first to say, Mags was a little odd. She wore strange clothes, never picked up a mop for as long as I knew her, and she had a strange affinity for sitting in the garden late at night. But she left her mark on Sweet Bay, and people won't soon forget that. Take me and Glory. We arrived here in South Alabama at the height of the 60s, two black faces and a whole town of white. She didn't bat an eye about opening her doors to us. Not only that, she talked us out of leaving when we thought we'd overstayed our welcome.
She was a strong woman a step ahead of the times. Sure, some people made fun of her. Small-minded people will do that. And kids. Kids laugh at anything different from them. But most of the adults in town knew that she was a necessary part of life here in Sweet Bay. A necessary part of our lives, for sure. Major's right, Bert said. And like Mrs. Busby said in that article, Mags was the town matriarch, and she took care of people. She never seemed to have extra money to put into the house, but money would show up when someone needed help. I stopped trying to figure her out a long time ago. She is who she is, or was, and we loved her for that. End of story. That was just it, though. They had all known there was more to Mags than she let on, and the townspeople respected her for her help in times of need. I, on the other hand, took her for exactly who she was on the surface, never bothering to consider that a full, rich life had been waiting just underneath. I realized I loved her life, her spirit. I loved who she had been all along. Chapter 39, Mags, 1976. I wasn't normally a church-going woman. Back in Mobile, we attended the Episcopal Church, although I always got a feeling it was more because of the beauty of both the stained glass and the congregation. The Methodist church right down the street would have been fine, but it didn't have glass brought in from Europe, and couldn't claim the mayor of Mobile and the head of Bay Imports as members. Dot and Bert had been going to Baldwin Baptist since they moved in, and they asked me to accompany them every Sunday, and every Sunday I declined. The house was quiet on Sunday mornings, and I usually spent those hours on the dock or in my garden. Why mess up a perfectly good morning with fire and brimstone and a healthy heap of guilt to go on top? You should try it just once, Dot said to me one Saturday evening as I tiptoed through my garden, picking bell peppers. What can it hurt? It might even help. What makes you think I need help? Just think about it, Dot said. No one's going to make you walk the aisle if you don't want to, and it may make you feel better to let go of, well, anything you may be holding on to. Dot was many things, but settle wasn't one of them. Why do you think I need to feel any better than I do right now? I'm fine. Dot moved closer to me, sidestepping a tall pepper plant. I've been here for 16 years. That's 16 years of watching you walk around with a weight on your shoulders that you never talk about and pretend isn't there, and watching you love someone who's never coming back. I drew in a quick breath and stepped back. Don't get mad. Just listen to me for a minute. You are a strong woman in every area except one, William. You've told me 1,000 times that you're over him, but it just is not true. I know he came in here and set your world on fire, but it was a long time ago, and life goes on. After all these years of being your best friend, I think I've earned the right to say this. You need to let him go. So much for trying to look strong. I wasn't ready to give up. But would it free me if I did? I wasn't sure I even wanted to be free. What if, miracle of miracles, he did come back one day? If I'd already shut my heart off and let him go, I might not be able to kick it into gear again. I put my arm around Dot. I'll think about it. Surprise crossed her face. I thought you'd slap me for sure. Have I ever done anything to make you think I'm a violent person? She smiled. Maybe not, but after Robert left, I told Bert to hide the oyster knife just in case he ever came back. Not long after that conversation, I gave in. I won't even ask what changed your mind. Just be ready at 11, Dot said, and try to wear something normal. I didn't tell her, but what made me change my mind was a simple question from Jenny that literally stopped me in my tracks. She and I had taken a stroll before dinner, and after chatting about her biology homework and the roses growing outside Grant's Hardware, Jenny took a deep breath. I knew something was going on in her mind, but I also knew just enough about teenagers to know if I came out and asked her what was wrong, she'd never tell me. "Mama, how did it feel when you and Dad fell in love?" I was so unprepared for that question. I stopped putting one foot in front of the other. She turned. "What are you doing? We're in the middle of the street." I followed her to the sidewalk, trying to come up with an answer. "I know you don't like to talk about him," she continued. Mabel told me Mark Kupek is in love with me. She asked me if I'm in love with him, but how am I supposed to know? What did it feel like with you and Dad?" Which one? The man she thought was her dad or the real one? I still hadn't given Jenny the letter I'd written on the beach in Gulf Shores, even though she was now approaching high school. Every time I gathered the courage to pull the letter out of its hiding place and take it to her, I lost the nerve. She'd be rocking on the back porch with a paperback in her hands, or laughing with friends on the end of the dock, or playing checkers with Bert. She was content with her life and the family she had at the hideaway, and I couldn't bring myself to shatter the peace. Her question about love made me realize I'd put myself and her into a bind by not laying out the truth and letting her decide how to feel. Instead, I'd chosen the lens through which she'd view her family. But my daughter had asked me about love, and the only true love I knew was William, so I told her the truth. It was electric, like 1,000 butterflies in my chest or 1,000 balloons flying free. Sometimes being apart was even better than being with him because I could anticipate seeing him. When we'd finally see each other again, the air between us would crackle and snap, and I couldn't cross the room fast enough to be next to him. It had been a long while since I'd thought of those first weeks with William. Was that all love was? Electricity, excitement, anticipation? No, not at all. That's how it felt. But love is a choice you make in your head, too. I knew I was in love with your father because I couldn't imagine my future without him. I didn't want to imagine it. He became such a part of me that I knew if he wasn't there, I'd lose a part of myself, too. Did you? Lose a part of yourself? A small part, I said. But I had you, and you opened my heart up in ways I never expected. You, my dear, were a balm for that wound. So were our house and our friends. I have a lot of good things in my life, but I still haven't forgotten him. We walked in silence a few moments before she spoke. I'm definitely not in love with him. She might as well have said, "I'd rather not have chicken for dinner tonight." My Jenny, so uncomplicated. "Who is Mark Kupek?" I asked. "Just a boy," she answered. I laughed and put my arm around her thin shoulders. "My sweet girl." "That's how it is. They're always just a boy, until they're not." The church service was much like I'd expected it to be. Lots of flowered hats, big smiles, hand-clapping hymns, and a good old fiery sermon peppered with "mm-hmm" and "preach it" from the congregation. But something happened during the prayer time. After lifting up every injury and ailment in the congregation and the tribulations of every possible extended family member, the preacher stopped and called for a time of silent prayer. His voice lost its showman's edge and grew raspy and honest. I'm sensing there are folks here who need one-on-one time with God. No sweaty preacher up here spouting off about everything they should be thinking or feeling. Just you and God. If that's you, I encourage you to close your eyes right now and listen. The organist started up with a melancholy tune that drew congregants to the front altar like a magnet. My butt stayed planted on the pew. If you hear God's still, small voice, don't worry about me or anyone sitting around you. I just ask you to listen to what he might have to say to you this morning. The church was quiet except for the organ. I closed my eyes and tried to listen for that voice. Since the day Jenny asked me about falling in love with William, I'd been more aware than usual of his shadow trailing me. He'd been gone for years, yet he was still a very real presence in my life. Dot let me know in no uncertain terms that the weight I'd thought I'd hidden well still sat on my shoulders in full view of everyone around me. I wasn't always on the best terms with God, but I was thankful he had given me William at all. If William hadn't been living at the hideaway when I moved in, there was no chance I'd still be there now. I would have stayed a few nights, felt the heavy weight of that fancy ring on my finger, and probably gone right back to Mobile and to Robert, continuing to scratch out an existence in the thing we called a marriage. But William had been there, and my life was profoundly different because of him and my time at the hideaway. I was thankful, but Dot was right. I was no longer the 22-year-old I was when I met him. I was almost 40, and my right to be a love-struck girl had passed its expiration date. He was not coming back. With my eyes squeezed shut and that organ droning on, I pulled my shoulders back and lifted my chin. God, I know we haven't talked in a while, but... The preacher clapped his hands. Thank you, Lord, for that time of prayer and silence. Can I get an amen? Mrs. Betty Joe, how about Onward Christian Soldiers? Betty Joe fired up the organ again. Mouths opened in song and hands lifted in praise. The time of prayer finished. Fine then. I looked up at the rafters and winked. I wasn't ready to let go anyway. Chapter 40, Mags, 1980. My Jenny found love at 18, too young in my eyes, but I quickly realized I had no need to worry. Ed Jenkins was no Robert Van Buren. Ed doted on Jenny, but he also pushed her to challenge herself. At his urging, she enrolled in a culinary program at the community college. She was always helping Bert in the kitchen, but I'd never thought of culinary school. Ed took a bite of her seafood gumbo one night and said, "You need to open a restaurant, Jenny." The idea for Jenny's Diner grew out of that early evening dinner, consumed on the dock at sunset, surrounded by our friends. Once darkness overtook the sun, lightning bugs popped out in the shrubs and trees. From the dock, they made the place look alive. Jenny and Ed married less than a year later, and little Sarah Margaret arrived 10 months after that. Sarah had the good fortune of loving attentive parents and a multitude of grandparents who doted on her day and night. As Jenny's Diner grew in popularity, our job as stand-in parents grew in importance. Bert learned how to operate an easy-bake oven. I became proficient in the rules of Go Fish. And Glory's knitting needles became fairy wands in Sarah's little hands. Back then, Sarah thought the hideaway was a magical palace, and I never corrected her because, in a way, it was. Sarah looked a little like Ed, but a lot like me. She had my skin coloring and dark, rebellious curls. That hair flew behind her as she ran from room to room through the house. She'd flee from anything resembling a brush or a hairband, so her hair grew long and wild, especially during the summers, when she was out of school and spent most of her time at our house. I sometimes tried to imagine what Sarah would look like as a young woman, or as an adult, but I couldn't see anything other than the carefree child before me. I got to where I couldn't allow myself to imagine William coming back for me, or even Jenny, especially once she became a woman with her own family, her own roots. For some reason, it was easier to think of him coming for his granddaughter. Occasionally, I'd allow myself the luxury of imagining Sarah and William together. I'd give myself over to an afternoon's worth of a daydream about the two of them finding each other later in life and knowing immediately that something connected them, something potent and essential. They'd be drawn to each other, and they'd trust it, even if they didn't know why. Jenny's death on the rain-slick highway shattered me. It was unspeakable. Not only had I lost my daughter, but I'd lost the last tie I had to William. I'd loved my daughter for the person she was, and she knew that, but I also loved William through my love for her. When Jenny was gone, it felt like he was finally gone, too. But the real truth was, William was gone the minute he made the decision to leave the hideaway all those years ago. I should have accepted that fact much earlier, but it was easier to hang on. After all, I hadn't decided what exactly I was going to tell him in his workshop that day. I wasn't going to ask him to leave. I don't think I was, anyway. I suppose I thought we'd figure it out together, like he'd said about so many things. I may have made the choice by not outright refusing my father all those years ago, but William took the decision out of my hands by leaving on his own. I don't know how he knew Robert was back in the picture, but I suppose he did what he thought was honorable. All I had left of him were the few things he made for me during our short time together. The pieces of furniture, the bench in the garden, the tiny replica of the house, the one that should have been ours, built into a quiet cove on the bay, undiscovered by anyone but us. But life doesn't always work out the way it's supposed to, does it? Chapter 41. Sarah. August. I called William at the number he gave me, and we made plans to see each other the next day. He said he'd make a day of it and visit some friends from his days at the hideaway, Gary and Starla. Starla? I asked. She gave herself that name back when she wore all black and smoked 20 cigarettes a day. It's a miracle she's still alive. I think her real name's Betty. When he arrived in town, I directed him to the outrigger for lunch, where we found a table on the deck overlooking the water. I wanted to tell him about the possible fate of the house, not to mention our family connection, but I was nervous about his reaction to both. To stall, I told him about leaving Sweet Bay, landing in New Orleans, and opening Bits and Pieces. "But couldn't you have opened your shop here?" "I've dreamed about Sweet Bay since I left 50-some years ago. It's a special place, you know. And the house, it has a pull." "I get it now," I said. "I think my time away finally showed me that. But after living with Mags for a decade, I guess I needed a break. Back then, she was a little odd." "What do you mean, odd?" "Maggie was many things, but I wouldn't describe her as odd." "I think it happened after you left. I understand more now, but as a clueless teenager, I just wanted out. And in coming back, I'm finding pieces of her life that I never knew existed." He smiled, but it was half-hearted. "If it took her passing on for you to come back to your home and understand more of who she was and who you are, well, maybe something good can come from something so sad." I shrugged. "Maybe so." Bubblegum snapped as someone approached behind us. "Y'all ready to order something?" The waitress asked without looking at us. I recognized her as the same waitress from my dinner here with Alan. William glanced over the menu and ordered a fish sandwich. I chose the grilled shrimp salad, and we both ordered sweet tea. "You sure you don't want a glass of wine? Or three?" the waitress asked. I looked up at her and she winked. "No, thanks. I'm fine. I'll have that out to you in a few." She snapped her gum as she wrote our orders on her little notebook and walked away. I took a deep breath. I left something out the last time we talked. I wasn't ready to tell you then, but I don't think I can keep it in any longer.
"Then you'd better tell me."
"That little girl you saw the day you came back to the hideaway?" William nodded, and I swallowed hard. "You're right that she was my mother, but she was not Robert's daughter." William's brow creased between his eyes. "Mags and Robert never shared a bedroom once he moved in," I said, making my point clear.
"Then who..."
He turned his eyes to the water and clenched his jaw. "She... that little girl wasn't mine, was she?" I nodded. His mouth opened and closed. Then he shook his head as if shaking away a dream. "Are you sure?" Yes. In those last couple weeks before I left, something about Maggie was different. William dragged his hand across his face. She looked and sounded the same, but she felt different to me. I even wondered. He shook his head again. So all this time, and that day behind the house wasn't... He exhaled, blowing the air out with force. I looked away. Whatever his feelings were, they were private. When I glanced back at him, his head was down and he'd put his hand over his eyes. Finally, he sniffed and pulled a handkerchief out of his pocket. "I'm sorry," he said. "This is such a surprise. Where is she now? The little girl?" I hated to deliver another blow. Her name was Jenny. She and my father died in a car wreck almost 20 years ago. William took off his cap and held it in his hands, pulling at the edges with his fingers. This man had lived most of his life under a wrong presumption, and I'd just thrown open the shutters, letting in the light of truth. Should I have kept my mouth closed? He turned back to me. Up until I met Maggie, I'd lived much of my life without a family. My parents died young, like yours did. When I met her, I thought that would all change, that I'd finally be a part of something bigger than myself. But it wasn't to be, he shrugged. Not then, anyway. He pulled the corner of his mouth up in a small smile as he wiped his eyes again. This must be strange for you, too, but I'm glad you're here. Does that make sense? It does. I understand. The waitress brought our food, and we ate mostly in silence. I began to dread the silent car ride back to the house, but then William began to talk about his life after he left Sweet Bay. Despite the failed marriages, his life had been mostly good. When he left the hideaway, he moved around for a while, finding odd jobs to support him while he worked on his furniture. I was constantly on the road in my old truck, the bed filled up with planks and boards I'd pulled out of abandoned houses. I was always covered in sawdust. Still am, really. He looked down at his hands and dusted them off on his pant leg, even though they were clean. He found a few shops that agreed to carry his pieces, and his business took off. After coming back and seeing Mags and Robert together, he settled in Still Pond, a small farming community an hour north of Mobile, and he had been there ever since. It's a nice town. I've had friends over the years. I have a church, people who look in on me. Most of the town eats at a dining table or sits on a bench I made for them or their parents or even grandparents. I know most everyone there. It's been a good life, he said, nodding. Lonely at times, but a solid life. Sounds a lot like mine. You mean you don't have a fellow down in New Orleans waiting on you? I shook my head. Not in New Orleans. Here? For now, I suppose. I don't have much recent experience dealing with young people's relationships, but I can listen if you want. I wasn't in the habit of talking much about my relationships. Alan knew most of what was going on with me at any given time, but it had taken a while for me to feel comfortable sharing my life with him. For some reason, I felt okay telling William about Crawford. Talking about Crawford naturally led to talk of the house and how beautiful it was becoming. I rounded it out by giving him